This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're getting updates on the COVID-19 pandemic and our response to it. We'll talk soon about telehealth, the growing need for remote health care, and the challenges it's created for physicians and patients in Indiana. And later we'll talk with a legal expert about the new federal order on evictions. Before that, though, an update on how universities are handling the pandemic now that school is back in session. We're joined by Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. Graham, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
So Indiana University has been doing extensive testing since school started. Can you tell us what testing has been done so far and at what campuses?
Sure. And we've been doing quite a lot of testing in various formats and for different purposes. We feel at the university this is really kind of the only way and path we have to move forward and kind of be reemerged here in a college setting. And so some of the different approaches we have taken include kind of more mass kind of surveillance or mitigation style of testing. And, you know, we realize some of the imperfections with all these things we do in public health. But that's really the goal of public health is to do some of this mass screening and to catch as many positives as we can and to act on those. And so what we did initially at campuses where we have residential living, so that would be South Bend, Southeast, and New Albany, Indianapolis, and IUPUI, and IU Bloomington, as well as the Greek houses in IU Bloomington, anybody that we considered to be an on-campus resident did receive a rapid antigen test prior to them being allowed to move in. And so that helped us start with the lower viral load on campus. And that was the goal to divert and seeding those outbreaks on campuses, especially in those congregate living settings from the start. And in addition to that, prior to that, we had asked that those same on-campus residents get a test before they come. Because of course, you know, a negative test that day, is just a snapshot in time. It's just that moment and you could be infected even later that same day. That's also why we don't, you know, suggest people testing out of quarantine because the incubation period could be 14 days and you could still later develop infection. So we had this pre-arrival, this on-arrival, and now we're moving into what we call mitigation testing. And really, I think our aspirational goal and what we've seen with the studies and the fact that we have so many cases in the United States still, we are well beyond containment in the U.S., and that's a problem. And so, you know, the studies tell us that we should be testing students twice a week. Ideally faculty and staff once a week. And so we're moving towards that aspirational goal. We are actually building in-house labs to increase our capability to do that. But these first couple of weeks, we've unveiled this in the first week. It was, again, on-campus students that we evaluated. We're moving towards faculty and staff now this week, as well as all of our campuses. When I say all of our campuses, all of our eight main campuses, regional campuses and research campuses, but also our School of Medicine campuses. So we are doing kind of mitigation style testing at each of these areas. And so what we've been able to do, you can only make informed decisions based on the data. And so now we have this wonderful data of some of these locations and facilities and these different subgroups of people on different campuses. And now we can upweight and we can kind of review more intensely certain groups where we're seeing issues. And, you know, those people can be selected for additional testing. And so that's kind of the strategy that we're moving. Right now, we're using a saliva PCR test for that mitigation testing with an outside company. But again, by sometime mid next month, we're going to be starting to move that in-house like some other universities have.
I'm going to make an assumption here and correct me if I'm wrong. This is probably the busiest you've ever been, and you're doing it from home. What does your job at IU usually entail?
Well, this is kind of a percentage of my day job, but as you can imagine, that has been extremely amplified, and now I have literally hundreds and maybe thousands of wonderful colleagues across our system basically working with us. So normally my role is kind of more of a local health department role for the university. We actually have an MOU with ISDH, an agreement that allows us to enforce some public health rules on our campuses, including, you know, things like food inspections and recreational water inspections. And, you know, we get involved in communicable disease. And, you know, if we see an outbreak, maybe we want to rule out a foodborne or waterborne. And, we do respond generally to communicable disease outbreaks on campuses. We've had a measles case here or a few mumps outbreaks here over the years. And so it's been part of it. But you are exactly right. Nothing has been quite like 2020, I think, for all of us. But I vividly remember my first day back in the office this calendar year, January 6th, and talking with some colleagues and being like, hey, there's this novel viral pneumonia of unknown origin in China from this animal market. And that just sounds, one, that's just fascinating to us in public health and those of us that love to look at and study zoonotic and vector-borne diseases. But it kind of was a heightened sense. And then it was Martin Luther King Day when the news broke from China that it was passing person to person and that, you know, this started to spread into other countries. And that was the day that, you know, we kind of put the rest of IU administration executives on blast about it and could really see the writing on the wall. So, you know, we thought very early on it was going to be a pandemic. We jumped on that. We had, you know, we have thousands of international students. We have thousands of domestic students overseas doing international studies. And so that was a very early thing, very early on. And it is quite the bounce being at home with a 1 and a 4-year-old and you know, working with all these incredible people and trying to solve some of these issues and work towards this. So it's been a unique year, to say the least.
We're talking with Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. So what, I guess, has been the biggest challenge so far to pull off all of this work successfully?
A lot of it just logistics. You know, again, we are such a large university system with, you know, 100,000 constituents across many campuses, and, you know, we're global. So just the broad reach, I would say, is the hardest point, and just the scope and the scale of things. You know, as we said, we've had a few of us that kind of do this work on a day-to-day basis. But again, you know, that's obviously unsustainable for something like a pandemic at this level. And so those, I'd say, are the biggest challenges, logistics and scale.
Have you had to make any adjustments on how you're conducting the tests that you're conducting?
Certainly. And that's exactly what we wanted. We have a group of epidemiologists and biostatisticians and IT folks and some really great people that can really dig into this data. And so the value of doing about 50,000 arrival tests across our campuses gave us good data to work from. And yes, every few days, every couple of days, we review all of that data. Well, we review it daily, but we review it every few days with this team. And kind of determine and pick out where we think we need to look more. Do we need to look at off campus? Do we need to look at faculty or staff? Do we need to continue to test the Greek houses on the Bloomington campus based on what we've seen there? So that has been really valuable, and it's allowed us to adapt and adjust our testing strategies.
Are you running into any, I don't know, any trouble with that? I guess, for lack of a better term, protest from anybody? Is anyone not being cooperative?
On the whole, everybody's been wonderful. They understand the issue. I think regardless of what we're going to do and what we've seen this year already is that we're not going to please everyone, regardless of what action we take. And I think we've seen how divisive, for some reason, public health is in this country right now and all of that. And so I'd say massively on the whole, everyone's on board. Everyone understands. You know, I think some may feel that, you know, people are, you know, being punished or targeted. And it's not like that at all. The whole goal is public health and to identify these cases and to be able to stop that chain of transmission. And so, yeah, of course, you know, not everybody's going to be on board when we have 110,000 constituents across the state. But on the whole, I think everybody's been really wonderful in understanding and our ability to kind of do what we need to do to what we best feel is the best path forward, given our current situation.
Do you have a sense for how cautious students are being so far?
I think on the whole, they have been very cautious. And, you know, we don't want to lump some maybe that aren't following some of those healthy behaviors as well as others and kind of paint a broad brush there. But, you know, we do see in some of these subgroups, and again, that's published data and it's available online. We have 30 Greek houses now in quarantine because of the number of cases in these shared living environments or the number of close contacts that were in the house. And so we've seen higher positivity rates in those populations. And so we do see some correlations with that. And so those are things that we are working to adjust because that really seems to be fueling what we're seeing in the data.
There's been criticism, of course, levied at universities that, according to some, have been too quick to lay blame on students for failing to stay safe. It's been argued that universities aren't doing enough to keep students safe. Do you think that's valid in any way?
I think it could be valid for certain universities, certainly. And, you know, I think on the other hand, others have done everything that we feel that we can do. And, you know, that's why I'm so happy. I've really felt like for the first time in, you know, 8 months, honestly, just in the last month, that we've really kind of been on the offense here at IU as well. For the first time, we had the ball, you know, doing some of this testing and fighting back a little bit. And so, again, that is really the only path, because this nation honestly has failed in terms of being able to contain and mitigate this outbreak or get it to levels where you can actually do containment, where testing programs are not overwhelmed, where contact tracing programs are not overwhelmed. So we made some serious investments in that, and feel that those that are doing that, you know, I think are taking the best approach. University of Illinois, for example, they're testing all students twice a week and have developed their own saliva test in house. And that's just kind of, again, where we're going from an aspirational standpoint. So I think that is the only path forward. Now, some universities aren't providing asymptomatic testing or doing surveillance or mitigation testing. I think that's a big failure, because 40% of the tests or cases are asymptomatic. And in the student age population, that might be higher or similar. And you might have a lot of cases that are very mild. So you're not going to be picking up these things. And so universities that are testing quite a bit might see a lot of cases. But that's also because they're picking up some of these cryptic or pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic infections. One thing I did forget to mention, and I cannot not mention it, is we mentioned all the different types of testing we do. We do have symptomatic testing available as well at any time to any of our constituents at IU, faculty, students, and staff. And so we have an agreement with IU Health, and anytime we have a symptom, and again, in students, this could be headaches and loss of smell or taste. That might be it. It might be one of those. And so we really want people to be hypervigilant, go through the IU Health virtual app, get screened, get tested through that symptomatic pathway as well. So we have all those different tools in our toolbox.
Graham McKean is Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. Graham, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
We'll be back after a quick break to talk about telehealth with a leader at Parkview Health in Fort Wayne. And we'll be live for the rest of the show. So if you have questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. And environmental health at Indiana University. Graham, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
We'll be back after a quick break to talk about telehealth with a leader at Parkview Health in Fort Wayne. And we'll be live for the rest of the show. So if you have questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're getting updates on the pandemic and Indiana's response to it. We're shifting gears now to talk about telehealth and the growing need for remote health care. To help us out, we're joined by Max Mail, Vice President of Virtual Health at Parkview Health, which serves Northeast Indiana and Northwest Ohio. Max, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon, Matt. Thanks for having me.
And we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We'd love to hear your voice in the conversation today. So again, call 866-476-3881. So Max, you're the president of Virtual Health. What do you do?
Yeah, thanks. So we, at Parkview, we have had a virtual health option for the last several years, about 4 years now, where we recognized that the importance of digital health and virtual health was going to be coming about over the next few years. We did not know at the time that this was all going to happen, but certainly our world looks a lot different now for our team than it did back in February. So as the VP of Virtual Health, we kind of lead the strategy of how to connect to patients differently than we have in the past. So things like messaging providers or doing things digitally, and a lot of that comes down to video visits as well, as we've seen since the pandemic. One thing, we've just seen incredible growth in the industry as a whole in a very short time. Many of our peers in the industry agree that we've moved telehealth forward about 10 years time frame in about 3 to 4 months. So just an incredible undertaking for everyone involved, both at our team and those around health systems across the country. Just for some perspective, we went previously with some of our telehealth options, we would do a few hundred visits a month, video visits with patients remote. At one point in the pandemic, we were doing nearly 50,000 a month. And so an incredible amount of work that went on during that time.
What kind of a logistical challenge was that to adapt to that huge increase in remote care?
That was some very long weekends in March. There was a number of challenges that we had to scale up to accommodate that volume in a very short period of time. So without getting overly technical on it, when you start handling video visits, your bandwidth increases, and so you have to start evaluating your internet usage and your routers and your other components that go into the ability to just function with video visits. In addition to also having to train staff members, providers, and patients alike on how to access your healthcare differently than you were previously able to do that. So long hours, a lot of teams involved in the coordination of that when it comes down to the legality and the billing side, as well as just the functionality of the visits themselves. So a wonderful effort by many across the industry, and we had a great team at Parkview that was able to handle that.
How much trial and error was there in those first few weeks? Was that tough?
Yeah. So for us at Parkview, we were incredibly lucky that we had some foundational elements that, as you put it, we've kind of been trial and erroring over the last few years. So fortunately for us, we had pockets or areas where we knew how to do video visits, but we may have only been doing it with a few offices here and a few offices there. The great part about doing that over the last 3 to 4 years was when this all happened, not quite this simple, but we could essentially flip switches and enable that to be done at large scale once we had some of the infrastructure in place for that. So the great part of that is we had spent years kind of making some mistakes or working through that. That didn't mean that there weren't some hiccups along the way, but certainly there were. It was nice to have a period before this time where we could test that. Across the board, though, from the industry perspective, a lot of different pain points. Some of which some hospitals or health systems did not have infrastructure in place to safely do these video visits, and you saw a wide-scale adoption of many different platforms. So you had Zoom. You had FaceTime, you had patient portals that they may have been accessing. And I think we'll see some of that start to consolidate going forward. But at the time, people were just reacting to get any means necessary to connect with patients.
Is there sufficient guidance on best practices for telehealth? Where can hospitals that weren't prepared learn what to do?
That's a great question. So honestly, because the industry is relatively new, and we look to our physicians or providers for a lot of the protocols or guidance on this. I think it's important to keep in mind that telemedicine is not necessarily new medicine. It's just the same medicine that we're trying to deliver that connectivity to the provider differently. And so there is an industry group that's taking a look at the various protocols and potentially some safeguards that can be put in place, especially with this rapid expansion. But I think now the question, especially after the pandemic, is what could we potentially do more of with telemedicine safely? I say that because prior to the pandemic, it was a lot of low acuity visits. So those kind of like the pink eye, the allergies, some of those relatively simplistic visits that were being done with telemedicine. But when the pandemic forced everyone to close nearly all of their practices, the discussion was then on how do we take care of cancer patients? How do we take care of the very sick patients that need to connect with us? And I think that's where we'll see a lot of the protocol-driven components coming in place by various specialties. I think the specialties and physicians will determine what is appropriate to take care of patients when you're not able to sit with them face-to-face, and what can we do through video visits that perhaps we don't need to be in front of the patient for.
I remember early on in the pandemic, I had a virtual visit with my physician who I'd only ever seen in person before. I had an inner ear issue, and I thought, how is he going to figure this out over the internet, as opposed to me coming in and him actually looking in my ear? But sure enough, he did. How much of a challenge has this been for patients who do virtual visits with doctors? And do you have the resources or the time to help them with all these new challenges if they need it?
That is certainly, so I have to answer the second question first. The resources and the time is certainly a challenge, because that's not something that we've historically been doing remotely for folks. And so we were able to set up, I know our health system and many others were able to set up various call lines, various video tutorials to help patients work through that. I do think one of the goals as we develop some of this technology is always to make it as simple to use as possible. And so when you use an app and various technology like that, our goal really is to make it simple for the patients. So that doesn't mean that your first time you're going to necessarily figure it out. So we do try to provide guidance there. But, from the patient adoption side, like you referenced, there obviously during the pandemic, there was a need to be safe for both patients and providers. And so there was a lot of eagerness to adopt the use of the technology. We saw a high number of downloads for the apps. For patient portals and registration using the digital means to connect. And we saw a lot of satisfaction with that. So we did some surveys afterwards of patients. This may have been their first telemedicine visit, but high satisfaction rates in the 90% percentile points. So we really were sensitive to some of that, was making sure we were delivering care easily and in a way that met patients' needs, and still, even though this was a different interaction, still made them feel comfortable and satisfied with the care that they were getting. And same goes for our providers. We kind of had to talk to our providers. To website manner and bedside manner are two kind of different things. So how do you address a camera when the patient's not in front of you? But, you know, to your visit, a lot of that is just talking to the patient. You know how you feel. And we can gain so much knowledge from just speaking with you on your history and what you're feeling that we don't always have to necessarily be in front of each other.
We're talking to Max Mail, Vice President of Virtual Health at Parkview Health, which serves Northeast Indiana and Northwest Ohio. And so how have insurance companies had an impact on this shift to telehealth? Have they adapted as quickly as they need to?
That I love this question. So I think that they were able to adapt very quickly during the pandemic. And I think I am hopeful that that is one thing that will stick. So some context for that. Previous to the pandemic, one of the biggest barriers we faced in delivering care to a patient's home or remotely, wherever they may be, was that insurance companies just simply didn't pay for those most of the time. Unless you were going to a site that might be owned by the healthcare system, which really is not as convenient as being able to sit on your couch at home. So one of the first things done during the pandemic was that CMS or Medicare provided guidance that those home visits would be covered. And that opened a significant amount of opportunities for patients and healthcare systems to deliver that care. So I think going forward, that's still not finalized, but we are definitely hopeful that especially for existing patients, that we can continue to see those home visits being covered under the patient's insurance. Prior to that, you could pay for it out of pocket if you had access to some of those options. But there's nothing better than being able to cover it with your insurance plan.
Do we have numbers on the on how often it is that a telehealth visit then is determined to need in-person, need to become an in-person visit, I guess? Like, how often will you get on a Zoom call with a doctor and the doctor then says, you're going to have to come in? Do we know?
Well, so for us at Parkview, we've been doing this for a few years. We do have some of that information from a primary care perspective. So when you go see your own doctor, we can compare that. So for those types of visits with, like I was mentioning, the allergies and the pink eye and the poison ivy, those types of visits, we see those about 90 to 91% of the time historically. We've been able to treat that with a video visit. About 8% of the time, then, we have to send you in for an in-person visit that may be at your provider or at an urgent care or walk-in clinic site. And then about 1% to 2% of the time, historically, it's some sort of a condition that we want you to be seen urgently, and we would recommend an emergency room visit for you. So with that said, you know, about 90% of the time, and I think we'll see this going forward, we should be able to treat most conditions virtually. And we haven't really talked much about devices, but as we look to the future, I think there will be some advancement. There certainly has been advancement there on devices that are created for use in the home. And those devices will allow, for instance, an otoscope where you could have shown your ear infection to your provider, and they would be able to live stream that with you. Those tools are coming down in price. They're available at some retail outlets. And I think we'll see the adoption of those going forward that'll, again, just improve that the accuracy of the diagnosis and treatment from home.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from patients about all this?
So far, so good. We have seen that about 93% of the time patients want to use a video or would use a video visit again in the future. And overall, almost the exact same percentage was highly satisfied with the visit that they had. So that's not just the low acuity visits. Those are the visits with any specialty care or any of the visits happening during the pandemic. I think where we see a lot of that satisfaction, and in the industry, it's the same. That's not just a Parkview number. Where we see a lot of satisfaction is it's so convenient for patients to be able to connect. You don't need to go sit in a waiting room with other sick patients. Just the time that you save, you don't have to drag your other children. I know we were talking on earlier about with the previous caller about his kids. And same for me. If I have one kid that's sick, I would have to bring the other with him. But fortunately, you don't have to do that with a virtual visit. Everyone can just be on the couch together. So I think there's so much in the way of convenience that patients are really happy with that. And even if there's some trepidation about how the call is going to go, the convenience and satisfaction seems to overtake that fairly quickly.
How much of an obstacle has it been to bring patients around who maybe aren't as technologically literate as they need to be to pull this off? I think I'm obviously thinking of older folks who either maybe don't have a computer, or if they do, they're not quite sure how to use it. Is that a common problem?
Yeah, that goes back to your question on support. We have had to support some folks like that and evaluate how patients are accessing us. Using the app is different than using a browser. Not everyone keeps their computer as up to date on things as well. So all of that has an impact. You know, surprisingly, generationally speaking, the use of our digital tools is almost equal across the board. So some of that, I think, has to do with some of the aging generations just consume healthcare more. So when you start to look at the convenience offered to them, especially as they may have many visits in a month or in a year, there's a lot of convenience offered for a video visit. And then, of course, with the younger generations, I think that's just how they expect their care a little bit more. So for some of the young parents or younger generation, they may not consume as much health care, but they do expect it to be delivered in this different way more than ever. And there has been some challenges from a support side for some that are not as tech savvy. But again, our goal really is to design tools that are easy to use. And it's less than you would think. I know personally, I've been surprised, pleasantly surprised at those using it. I think our oldest patient so far has been in their 90s. So it's used by everyone.
How do you think health providers and systems overall are handling the pandemic so far? Are you worried about many of them not knowing how to adapt or not being able to adapt?
Yeah, I think some of the financial constraints put on health systems due to the pandemic, certainly as surgeries stopped happening and as patients no longer came to be seen for some of that care as things were shut down for a period, that posed some significant financial barriers for health systems. And I think the ability to invest in new technology and new equipment will suffer from that. That obviously remains to be seen over the next few years, but I think it's such an important part to continue to invest in that I hope we still see that happen. But I do worry that some of that will be jeopardized.
Max Mail is Vice President of Virtual Health at Parkview Health, which serves Northeast Indiana and Northwest Ohio. Max, thanks so much for your time and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So we'll be back after a quick break to talk about evictions and a new federal order that bars them for most renters until the end of the year. I'm Matt Pelser, and we're back in just 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We've been talking today about the pandemic, how Indiana University is testing its students, and how the lockdown has led to a sudden need for remote health care. And now we're getting an update on evictions. We did a show a few weeks ago about the state of evictions in Indiana and the concern from many that things were about to get out of control. Now the Trump administration has announced an order that puts a moratorium on evictions for most renters until the end of the year. To talk about it, we're joined by Brandon Beeler, director of the Housing Law Center at Indiana Legal Services. Brandon, thanks for coming back.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me today.
And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments on evictions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. So, Brandon, what does this new federal order say?
Sure. So on September 1st, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an order that isn't active yet, but it's called the Temporary Halt in Residential Evictions to Prevent the Further Spread of COVID-19. The order came out September 1st, about Wednesday around 4 o'clock, and it is active upon publication in the Federal Register, which is scheduled to happen tomorrow, at least at this point. The CDC is using their authority under 42 CFR section 70.2, which is authority to issue orders and directives to prevent the spread of communicable diseases. So it's come kind of without too much anticipation. It was a surprise to many landlords and tenant advocates as well.
So were you expecting this? Was this a surprise?
It was a surprise. There's been some chatter, obviously, especially based, your show's covered it, on whether there were going to be additional protections either coming from the state or the federal level. I think most folks were looking at Congress at some point to maybe act, but coming from the CDC especially was another surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was surprised when I heard. I knew that the Trump administration were doing things. I also knew that Congress had the authority. It seemed to come out of left field that the CDC would be able to do something about this.
Exactly. Again, and it's this broad authority. I've looked into it a little bit. They have this authority to take action to prevent the spread of communicable diseases. And so a lot of the directive is written under that guise, and it's under, in the spirit of preventing spread of COVID-19.
So let's bring it home. For people in Indiana, what impact will this have in practice?
Sure. So assuming it does get published, this order gets published tomorrow, it will be active, and the states, it applies to all states where there are active cases of COVID-19, which Indiana certainly does, and in states where there are no eviction moratoriums, or at least no eviction moratorium that has less protections. Like, this is the baseline protection for states. So under that directive, Indiana, this order will protect Indiana Hoosiers. It is limited to non-payment of rent issues or to non-rent payment of rent cases. There is some blanket permissions and allowances for landlords, for tenants who engage in other lease violations to still pursue the eviction action. But starting from the start, the beginning, in order for a tenant to get this protection, they need to submit or issue an affidavit or a declaration to their landlord. It's an affirmative duty on the tenant to provide this declaration to a landlord that they are covered under this protection.
You've been one of many who are concerned about a big increase in evictions here in Indiana caused by the pandemic, and its effect on the economy and the job market, of course. How much help is this new order going to be, or does it go far enough?
You know, it remains to be seen. It's a pretty broad directive, as you probably have seen. It's not even enacted yet, or it's not law yet, or actionable at this point, and again, until tomorrow. Presumably the idea is that, tenants who have lost jobs or are unable to pay their rent due to either a loss in income or other reasons shouldn't be evicted during this time. But, again, this declaration is pretty minimal, and I can talk more about that in a bit. We have some forms from our office, and I know that the state's going to work on getting some of these out for tenants to kind of pull off to give to their landlords when this is active. But, again, I think the question may be, when tenants submit these affidavits or these declarations, they may be challenged by landlords. And then, whether it's a possession hearing for eviction or whether it's an evidentiary hearing, it's yet to be seen.
Well, you go ahead and talk about those affidavits.
Great. So in order to be qualified as a tenant, there's a certain affidavit, and the CDC at the end of their order actually provides kind of a sample or the template for what it's supposed to look like. Our office, we've made some fillable templates for folks, and then they're actually the Suffolk Law School Innovation and Technology Lab issued an online form today that's easy for folks to go online and fill out. There's no duty of the landlord to inform tenants that this directive and this order is out. It is incumbent on the tenant to give their landlord this declaration. Again, I don't have too much because it's not been in practice yet, but theoretically there's no timeline in the order. So if a landlord does pursue an eviction action, there's nothing preventing the tenant from, frankly, bringing the affidavit to court and saying, here, you need to dismiss this case.
So who's eligible?
So the eligibility requirements are kind of found within the declaration. There's a number of them. The main kind of – there's an income requirement or an income eligibility, and there's three different categories. The first is that the tenant expects that they will earn no more than $99,000 of annual income in the calendar year 2020, or if it's a joint filing, no more than $198,000. The second line of eligibility is that the tenant was not required to report income in 2019 to the IRS. Or finally, the third category for application is the tenant received an economic impact payment, which is really a stimulus check under the CARES Act. If any of those three are applied to the tenant, then they are applicable for this protection.
Is there anything in there about, I don't know, a rate of infection in the local area where they may live? It seems like if the CDC put this down, that maybe that would be among the list of I guess, exemptions, perhaps.
Sure. That's been a very common question that's come up. And as far as I can tell in reviewing this and other legal experts, the CDC did not put any minimum requirement. It's just a broad – the state has reported cases of COVID. I guess since they use plural, theoretically, there could be two cases that would be enough to qualify. But, yeah, there's no rate of infection rates that are involved in this directive.
How difficult do you expect it might be for people to get approved after they apply?
Well, so that's sort of where it lies, and where the, you know, and I will say that I know the Indiana Supreme Court and the Landlord Tenant Task Force is working quickly to try to give some guidance to courts throughout the state, because, you know, it came out quickly without much explanation. So again, in order to get the protection, all the tenant has to do is, again, agree and verify under a sworn declaration, which the language of that is in all the sample forms, that, you know, they meet that income requirement. There's a few other requirements, such as they either tried or they didn't apply for, or they weren't eligible for rental assistance. You know, they are willing to make minimal payments, just things like that. Tenants don't have to prove it. They just have to say, yes, this is true, and give it to the landlord, and that is the end of it. Now, if the landlord pursues an eviction case, that's where it's a lot of unknown, whether the courts are going to look to see if this is filed and automatically, you know, continue them or dismiss them, or whether, if the tenant hasn't done the declaration yet, whether the court's going to allow the tenant to make the declaration in court in order to prevent the eviction. Those are some of the questions we're not sure about at this point.
We're talking about the new moratorium on evictions that was put down by the Trump administration and the CDC as well. Brandon Beeler is the director of the Housing Law Center at Indiana Legal Services, and he's joined us for this segment. So how do you think that enough people are going to know about this as an option for them?
You know, Matt, I'm really concerned about that. You know, the rental assistance program, both the one by the city of Indianapolis and the statewide one administered by HCDA, those programs have, you know, shut down applications due to, you know, using their funds. And we, to this day, are still getting a lot of tenants calling us saying they didn't know about those. And I, you know, from my perspective, I thought those were very well advertised. So, yes, the fact that it is it's incumbent on the tenant to provide this declaration and they may not know, that's certainly a concern.
Is there anything in place, whether in Indiana or elsewhere, that you've heard of at the state or local level that this would circumvent, that might be that might offer more protections to a tenant or maybe a landlord? But it doesn't seem like if it comes down from the federal level, that the tenant might be more protected than the landlord. But I could be wrong.
Sure. I mean, certainly, I mean, the penalties that are contemplated in the declaration are sort of twofold. There are, there are criminal penalties actually that are enforceable by the DOJ for anyone who doesn't comply with the order. So that, you know, would seem to be on landlords. But again, the tenants have a criminal penalty as well, because the declaration they have to give to their landlord, they have to sign it under the penalties of perjury, meaning it's a true and accurate statement. So, you know, those will be some of the penalties for failing to comply with the act. But yeah, so but again, a lot of them remain to be seen. The only other heightened protections that at this point, there are no other heightened protections. Again, Indiana's eviction moratorium expired on August 14th. So unless the state enacts another moratorium that has higher protections, this is the CDC's moratorium is kind of the baseline protections they're saying all states with active COVID cases have to enact.
I'm really, really glad you're here. I'm the furthest thing from a lawyer, so I appreciate you walking me through this. So the National Multifamily Housing Council, which represents landlords, has come out against the order, saying it'll be harmful to small landlords. Is there truth to that, at least here in Indiana?
Well, I'm going to presume here they mean the harmful is that it's, you know, I think from my understanding of the landlord's side is that it's preventing them from being paid, or there's disincentives for tenants to pay their rent, and landlords, especially as you say, the small ones, are losing money. And I'm certainly sympathetic to that and understand that. Our hope is, and again, the CDC isn't super clear about this. I will say the difference between this and, you know, other moratoria we've discussed, like the CARES Act, this one does allow landlords to continue to charge late fees. Rent is still due under the CDC moratorium, so there's no waiving of rent or charges. So the bills are, you know, continuing to increase for the tenants. However, what my hope is, and what we're hoping for, you know, we're trying to encourage tenants that come to our office is, you know, Indiana's Supreme Court came out with a landlord-tenant settlement program a week or two ago. We still are encouraging tenants to try to maybe enter repayment agreements and set up and also from the landlord's perspective, maybe even make some partial payments in good faith. So, you know, while the law, the CDC, again, permits this, no eviction or no judicial action against a tenant for non-payment, hopefully this actually, the directive works in the best way it can. You know, it would encourage kind of in a lower stress setting for tenants and landlords to sit down and try to engage in some sort of settlement.
Is there a key conflict in all of this that's keeping advocates who want more protections put in place from getting what they want? What's the biggest obstacle?
I mean, I think the biggest obstacle is the broadness of this directive. I mean, certainly from a tenant's perspective and from our client's perspective, you know, the majority of calls we have gotten, especially in the past few weeks since the Indiana's moratorium was lifted, have been non-payment of rent because of COVID, because they've lost jobs, hours have been reduced. They've had medical bills or had to take care of sick family members. So this is, from our perspective, the number one issue of why tenants are struggling, why tenants might face an eviction. So, you know, it's good in that sense because, again, it hopefully encourages both sides, both the tenants and the landlord side, to maybe come to the table while nothing can happen and a tenant can't, lose their home, again, in the middle of a pandemic. They can maybe be encouraged to try to get some sort of settlement and avoid having to go to court altogether.
But to the other point, look at what groups like yours are doing and also what Marion County has done in enacting their own protections. Were there protections coming down the pipeline that perhaps you were interested in or maybe you've heard of happening around the country that when this came along, maybe it stole the spotlight and the other protections maybe would have been better for tenants?
Oh, I see. That's a great question. I mean, I will say just again, from my perspective and for our clients, not losing their homes and not being forced on the street is probably the best result. So this does achieve that result of not being, evicted during a pandemic or losing their homes during a pandemic. The other protections that I've kind of contemplated and, have seen other states do have been certain ones more in a judicial standpoint, such as rather than having the first hearing be a possession hearing and the tenant has to go right away and doesn't know their rights, doesn't really, maybe hasn't followed the CARES Act or any other protections, so maybe slowing down the court process. But I don't think this order or this directive interferes with that, only in the fact that, like you said, maybe or suggested that from a policy standpoint, people may think this is enough for tenants.
Do you think this federal order could have any effect on state leaders in Indiana and the likelihood they might take actions to help prevent evictions?
That would be a great result from this. I mean, I think that it's been, suggested and said many times, one of the biggest problems and why that we see in the state we have an eviction crisis is due to the lack of parity in the judicial setting between landlords and tenants. So, the fact that now this is, tenants really, I think the state's a pretty free to contract, right of business state. So, now that tenants can't be evicted and landlords don't have that option currently, this is a great opportunity for both sides to come to the table and try to find some reasonable solutions that benefit both sides and also don't continue to increase our eviction crisis.
And in about 30 seconds, can you remind us what the Housing Law Center at Indiana Legal Services is doing to help right now?
Sure. We're doing our best to give out some guidance and some forms and templates based on this new directive that just came out. And again, will be enacted or that should be active tomorrow. We have a number of different programs, such as the Tenant Legal Assistance Program, the Eviction Avoidance Project, and we work with the City of Indy on the Tenant Information Line. So we really are trying to work on a lot of pro se packets, which mean packets that people who may not qualify for services can use to go to court and represent themselves and have information. So we're just trying to keep everyone informed and giving any information and forms that we can give to those who may need it.
Brandon Beeler is director of the Housing Law Center at Indiana Legal Services. Brandon, thanks as always.
Hey, thanks so much, Matt. I appreciate it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast is wherever you get podcasts. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.